Hello, friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And today is actually the anniversary of my late Uncle Charles's death, which I feel a little bit of guilt about. I'm partially responsible for it. When I was growing up, during the summers, my mom would drop my brother and I off with my aunt and uncle, Aunt Isabel and Uncle Charles, and they had this orange grove in the back of their house. And one of my favorite things to do in the day would be to take the oranges off the tree and bring them into my uncle's workshop, where I would place them in the vise that he had and squeeze the vise until the orange pulp broke out of the orange. And I was essentially just mindlessly juicing my uncle's oranges that they'd worked so hard to grow. I just take them in the day and put them in that vise until they told me to stop. But the vise itself and the floor underneath the vise became very sticky with all the orange juice that I had squeezed out of my uncle's oranges. As it turns out, in Greenway, Florida at the time, they'd been having this problem with all these stinging flies that had been sort of flourishing in one of the nearby swamps because of a frog die-off related to the Herkington accident at the Herkington aluminum mill. Spilled a bunch of aluminum hydrate into the local swamps, killing all the frogs, which then, of course, the birds would eat the dead frogs, and they also would die. So for that summer, the swamps had just turned into death pits, just filled with rotting frogs and rotting birds, and all these stinging flies had just been breeding and breeding and breeding inside the carcasses of the birds and the frogs. And at night, if you listened, you could hear the buzz of these flies in the nearby swamps. But nobody thought anything of it, except you just didn't go in the swamps, because these flies, you could die. They could kill you because they had also accumulated a little bit of this chemical from the toxic spill, and so they were poisonous, stinging flies. Well, I shouldn't have kept juicing those oranges in my uncle's vise, but I don't know. I guess I was taking out rage or something, and my uncle and my aunt had left for the day, and I went and got a basket of those oranges and just spent the day just squeezing them in that vise, and forgot about it. You know, I had my fun and went off to play in the street. Well, my uncle and aunt came home, and he didn't go in his workshop. He didn't notice the mess that I'd made in there. And then the next day, that morning, he goes into the workshop, and that's when it happened. He'd opened up the garage door, and just a swarm of these stinging flies flew into the workshop. And the thing I can never forget is the sound of my uncle screaming, mixing in with the buzzing of those flies, the angry buzzing. There's this demonic hum, and then the gargling sound as they got into my uncle's mouth and his eyes, and it looked like smoke. It just looked like he was covered with this living, buzzing smoke, and he went running through the garage into the driveway, which he shouldn't have. He should have gone into the house, maybe then. But in the driveway, just more, it looked like I've never seen anything like it. It just looked like a giant black cloud composed of poisonous, contaminated, stinging flies, and they just fell on my uncle and carried him off. They say this is the first case. You can Google it. They say it's the first time that flies have carried a man away. And they took him into those swamps. They flew him back into those swamps, and a couple of days later, after a pretty extensive search, my uncle's body was discovered, and it was just bones, just bleached bones. The only thing they could use to identify him was the pack of Pall Malls laying nearby, because he didn't have any teeth. Normally, they would have done a dental search, but he wore dentures, so... And the dentures were gone. The flies had carried the dentures away. So, I'm just gonna play a song. My uncle played guitar, and, he recorded this a long time ago on a cassette player, so it's a little scratchy and hard to understand, but, this is my Uncle Charlie singing Fingered Everyone in the Neighborhood. It's the only known recording of his music. Fingered everyone in the neighborhood. The Duncan Trussell Family Art Podcast is brought to you by Amazon.com. Eventually, all of us will be living in numbered cubicles inside an Amazon.com warehouse where we'll be flown to heaven by drones. But before that happens, make sure you do your online shopping by going through our Amazon portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. Anything you buy on Amazon, they give us a small percentage of, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. And man, is Amazon great. They have literally everything. They have warehouses that stretch into infinity filled with every single thing. It's all in there. Whatever it is that you want, it's there. Artificial fingernails, textbooks, prosthetic limbs, earwax removal kits, nose extenders. They have that solvent that you can drop on your skin tags and melt it off, leaving tiny little pink craters where the skin tag used to be. Listen, nobody wants to go sliding around in the diarrhea that came spraying out of a toddler's asshole because he ate too many sugarless gummy bears on his way to the fucking mall. That's dangerous. You could get a concussion, or even worse, you could get a tiny sugary little sugarless little bit of that little bastard's diarrhea lodged in your mouth right under the gums, and it could get infected, and the infection could spread into your skull and into your brain, rotting your brain until your eyes turn white and little gray rivulets of memory and brain matter come oozing out your nose into your mustache. The last thing you'll smell is that stinky smell of sugarless gummy bear diarrhea as you go into a coma. That's what waits for you at the mall. You don't have to do that anymore. If you go to DuncanTrussell.com and go through our Amazon portal, the next time you go shopping at Amazon, they will give us a small percentage of everything you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you can contribute to your favorite podcast while avoiding getting a diarrhea-induced brain-eating disease that is going to transform your beautiful muscular brain into a mushy slurry of stinking bits of neurological muck oozing out your ears. You'll sneeze your brain into your girlfriend's face and then fall forward into your Applebee's soup. That's no way to die. Go to Amazon.com, but first go through our portal at DuncanTrussell.com. It's splattered all over the place. Just click on the portal, bookmark that link, and the next time you feel like going to buy hair extensions, the next time you feel like buying vibrators, the next time you want to buy Kleenex, toilet paper, Windex, I could say anything, and it's there. Clumps of armpit hair from World War II, it's there. Ovary sweetening gel, it's there. Just go through our portal. Please, I beg all of you to go through my portal. We're also brought to you by Sure Design T-Shirts. Sure Design T-Shirts creates T-shirts so soft you'll feel like somebody shoved your upper torso into the anus of a giant. We've all wanted to feel that, Everyone thinks that when they see movies about giants. Everyone wonders what it'd be like to climb into the giant's orifices and rest in that dark warmth. Well, now you can know what it's like to sleep in the rectum of a giant. Go to SureDesignT-shirts.com, put my name in Duncan, and you will get 10% off some of the softest shirts that have ever existed. In the days of Noah, there were these things called Nephilim. They were giants, and in those days, on a cold night, if you found a friendly giant, he'd probably let you sleep in his asshole. And it was a wonderful night for you if that happened. Well, that's one of the many things that we lost thanks to that awful flood that wiped out so many wonderful things. But now we can experience it again. Yes, now we can truly feel that primordial relaxation that comes from being in the sweet, deep pink of a giant stink. Also, we've restocked our shop, located at DuncanTrussell.com, and as always, we're sponsored by Audible. You can go to audibletrial.com/familyhour and sign up for a trial membership. You'll get a free audiobook. You can cancel. You get to keep the book. Okay, guys, let's get this thing going. Today's guest was mugged by the anti-malaria drug Larium in a train station in India. He had all of his memories completely wiped out by this terrible drug, was committed to an insane asylum in India, and had to reconstruct his identity. His book, The Answer to the Riddle Is Me, is about this experience. From the moment he came to in a train station in India to the long process of rebuilding his memory. It is an incredible book, and it's not just about amnesia. It's also about the dangers of some of the drugs that the pharmaceutical companies have no problem putting into the bloodstream of our species. And it's also deeper than that. It's a story of identity. It's a story of what we are when our past is stripped away from us. And it's great. So buy the book. And go visit David McLean by going to davidstewartmclean.com. I'll have links to the book, to his Twitter, to his website at duncantrussell.com. Now, everybody, please open your hearts and send love in the direction of today's guest, David McLean. My friend. Did I mention that? I'm friends with published authors.
Pimp's prostate.
One, the pimp's prostate was pickled with porridge. David McLean.
That's me.
Holy shit, man. I literally just finished your book. It made me cry. It's one of the best books I've read, man. It is such an accomplishment. And, wow, I'm just so amazed by your story. I had no idea, David. Now, before I continue raving, for those of you who, you know what? I'm going to introduce it in the beginning. So let me just continue raving. So, because it's not like people don't know you. And then we'll get into this thing. But, when I heard about this happening to you, I had no idea how catastrophic the event was. I don't think anybody had any idea, and you talk about this in the book a lot, but that, as I've been reading this and as the book escalates and you sort of progressively realize just how intense this event was that happened to you, it was like, it's a weird thing, man. It's like having a friend die or something, but knowing that they were resurrected. It's a strange, it was been a, just a crazy journey reading this book, David. And I want to, before we start talking about it, I just want to read a passage from the book, which is the suicide note about Larium. Can I read that? Do you mind?
Yeah.
I don't. That's, yeah, that's intense.
So this is when it really dawned on me. Hopefully this, stop me if you think this is like spoiling the book, David, because I don't. This is when it dawned on me how intense what happened to you was.
Yeah.
Because Larium, even in the last podcast when we talked about it, it hadn't occurred to me that there is the potential that you would go back into this state, or that it just seemed like something that sort of passes by, not something that you have to deal with for the rest of your life in a certain way.
Right. Like, I think everybody thought it was going to be like food poisoning, that like once you got it out of your system, you're okay. But what they didn't understand was that it just stayed in your system for a really long time.
Oh, God, man. That's where the horror of the and beauty of this story really, this really hit home for me. I'm just going to read this. This is the suicide letter of John O'Callaghan, who committed suicide 2 years after being treated with Larium. I know God will forgive me. No one could live with how I'm feeling now. I know I will never forgive the bastards that gave me Larium. I am now the same as when I first had it. Fully spinning, can't even walk properly, the walls are moving, my head feels like someone let a box of ants in it. Extreme pain in my head, I'm fully losing it. What does the future hold? Psychiatric wards? No way. I know I've always been a little bit different, even before I had Larium, but since it first blew my brains apart and then settled down, I've never been the same. Always dazed and confused, always physically sick. I never thought this could happen to me. Sorry, Mom, Dad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so I had to track the mom down and write her a letter asking for permission to print that. And that was some hard writing, to be like, so Mom, can I print your son's suicide note?
Wow.
Yeah.
What was her response?
She was like, she said, absolutely. She wanted as many people to know about Larium and what it had done as possible. So
God,
yeah, it's fucked up. It's a really fucked up drug. And it's funny because like one of the things I've been getting as I've been, touring, and you would love this, is that, I get this question sometimes where people will ask, now that you like, are on the other side of it and you've written a book and you have a wife and a baby, like, are you happy that this happened?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's this very specific American belief that you, in order for you to be happy now, you have to be happy about everything that happened to get you to now.
Right.
As opposed to saying, you know, what happened set me on this path to do what I'm doing now. But to say that that's the only option is basically to say that you have no imagination. Like all the different me's that could have been without this shit, all the different me's. I don't know. There's something American to feel like you've really learned from the experience and you're better because of it. I don't think people in Germany, like readers in Germany, feel that way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And I think you did a really good job of not just making it a dismal story of this catastrophe that happened to you. You did a great job of balancing an optimism that you naturally have and the tools that it seems like you use to find a ground to rest in. You mix that in with this sense of mourning and loss for a lot of who you were, a lot of memories that were just evaporated, maybe eternally, perpetually. The scene where those... these are just little tidbits from the book, friends listening right now. It's not really a spoiler. You know right away when you read the back that David McLean had amnesia. And so these are just little tidbits that I enjoyed in the book. So these aren't really spoilers, but that creepy part where those Indian kids pulled up in the motorcycle in front of your place and you yeah. don't remember what you did with them in those moments that you had full amnesia, that was chilling.
Yeah. And not being strong enough, and I still like feel humiliated that I couldn't ask them like what had happened. Right? Like I just couldn't. This was my chance to fill in that gap, and I couldn't do it. I was a coward. Because I didn't know who that person was who's hanging out with them, and I didn't know if I could trust that person.
Wow. Yeah, it's who knows what you did. To this day, you'll never know
right.
what you did.
Right.
Until the video emerges on the internet.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
You're just shoving chickens into a nun's asshole, screaming blood all over your face. This weird Islamic flags hanging it behind you.
Awesome. That would be really... God, that would be... That would be rad. That would make me very happy.
I know it would. I wanted to read this to you to see what you thought about this. Because in your book, what I really love about the book is the way that it explores the idea of self and the concept of what we are and how much of what we are is comprised of our memories. And right. once those have been removed, what's left? What is there? What are we? This is from the Wise Heart, A Guide to the Universal Teachings of Buddhist Psychology. And it's a Jack Kornfield book. It's really good. And he says, I'll read the quote at the very beginning. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. And that is Zen Master Dogen wrote mm-hmm. that. And then Kornfield writes, at the end of the Buddhist ordination ceremony in the sacred grove deep in the forest monastery, the new monk is given the first meditation instruction. It is the inquiry, who am I? A practice of systematic self-investigation starting with the body. We ask, am I the skin, the hair, the muscles and bones, the organs, or the blood? Am I this body? Modern science tells us that the molecules of the body are completely replaced every 7 years. If I am not the physical elements of this body, then what am I? Am I the stream of changing feelings? Am I the memories and perceptions? Am I the thoughts and concepts, the views and beliefs? Who am I? This is not a theoretical question. It is the most practical question for us to ask in the midst of our problems and our sorrows. Who do I take myself to be? At work, in my family, in my community, in my own heart? The way we answer this question can lead to entanglement and struggle, or no matter where we are, to freedom and ease. It is absolutely crucial to understanding the human predicament.
Wow. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's interesting because, like, in that is the who do I want to be? And in that is the answer, right? It's like the wanter is who you are. Mm. You're the wanter. That's outside of the person that you want to be, the person you aspire to be, the person that you are plotting somehow to capture and snare this personality to be yours. That's the person you are, is the wanter.
Right.
And in some ways, like outside of memory and outside of all of that other stuff, there's instinct. And I think that instinct is at least who I figured out I was outside of all of the memories that I didn't have. Like I was good with kids, like this weird thing where I'm good with kids even without my memory there to tell me that. And I'm a good teacher
yeah.
sometimes. There are just these things that are just part of who I am and what it, sort of the little guy in the back operating the controls. Yeah. That seemed to be it. Yeah.
But you keep moving back, though, and you're always faced with, like, if there's a wanter, for example,
right,
there has to be the awareness of the wanter.
Right. Oh, good point. And so then it's the awareness. It's the thing that's in dialogue with the wanter.
Yeah.
Right? That you have something there that's in dialogue with the wanter in order for the wanter to want.
Yeah, it's a dialogue, or is it just this awareness? You sort of go back and back and back into this thing. You follow this thing back. You get to the point where there's no more there's nothing else you can observe. You get
right
to that thing of trying to look at your own face when there isn't a mirror nearby, and that thing. What is that thing? What is that thing? That is a thing that I think. People do a lot of different things to get to that thing. So, you know, they meditate to get to that thing. They take wild quantities of LSD to get to that thing. But then sometimes you get to that thing accidentally. You get to that thing maybe before you're quite ready to get to that thing, unprepared, like being dosed, like the awful stories of people at a party who get dosed with LSD, and don't know that they've been given this thing. This seems to be what happened to you, only you weren't dosed with LSD. You were dosed with a partially government-manufactured neurotoxin that was supposed to treat malaria. So you don't even have friends to suspect. You know, you don't at least have deadhead
right
friends. If you had imagine if you had deadhead friends, you'd be like, it was fucking Rainflower again, son of a
God
bitch.
Damn you, Rainflower. Tom Bombadil, you dickhead.
Stop dosing my coffee, man. Do you know what I'm saying, though? It's like you had this it's just interesting that there it seems to be a mystical state that you are experiencing via having your memories erased.
I think it's interesting because I always think about it in a couple phases. Like, there's waking up on the train platform, and when I wake up on the train platform and I have no idea who I am, like, the fact that I don't know doesn't bother me at first. And I think that's a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
It's sort of like I'm not bothered because I don't know enough to be bothered by not knowing.
Mm.
And so it's sort of like I realize that how much of our personality, how much of our personal narrative is a way of structuring sensory data so it makes sense in terms of the context that we're placed in.
Mm.
But if you don't have that narrative, if you don't have that identity, suddenly all data is equal.
Yeah.
Like train platform, smell, rats and pigeons, all of it is equal in its relationship to you. Because, right, it's when you go into Walmart, if you go into Walmart, you would go crazy with all that data stimulation unless you knew that you were looking for the hot Cheetos. Like, you can eliminate all other data because it's just sort of like,
right,
I need hot Cheetos. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that's how I think most of us live our lives, in that sort of triage of errands. And our errands sort of determine our personalities.
Oh, wow.
And like, well, how much more of the world are we missing because it doesn't sort of feed into or direct us on our errands that we're out on?
Oh, that's amazing. And then the guilt associated when you don't have an errand, where you
right
find yourself just suddenly, you know, I sometimes I'll go and I'll sit out on my porch. I have a rocking chair and I'll just sit out on the porch without a book, nothing to do, nothing to listen to, nothing to do, and I'll sit there listening to the birds, and it's so great until the moment that I realize I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
It's like, shit, man, you got to do something. What are you?
God,
what are you doing? You can't just sit around. You can't sit around like some kind of slacker. You're slacking, boy. You got to do something. Get moving, kid. Get moving. And then
what if somebody saw me sitting here and asked me what I was doing? then I'm weird.
So these errands, it's so interesting how that is so, how there's like a life errand and it's composed of all the little errands that we run trying to finish this great big errand. And in the right. midst of that, and then that, you're right, that comprises what we consider to be ourselves. And you had a firsthand experience of what it's like to have that removed from you.
Yeah. Removed, and then so I was okay standing there for a bit, and then I was like, oh shit, should I have been on that train? And that's when my brain kicked in and started freaking out, like, what am I going to do next? And that's when my brain was like, I need to know who I am in order to know what I do next. And that's when a police officer found me and told me I was a drug addict. And I was so thankful for it, to him, for telling me that, because my brain then was able to organize the world in this new identity and just be like, this is who I am. I'm this drug addict and I'm waiting for this woman who's atrociously ugly. And we score and do drugs. And isn't that what we do in India together? All of it untrue. This woman, Christina, never existed. I have no idea who she is. But I can picture her face right now, even though she never existed.
Yes. The mind manufactured memories for you to try to fit in to anything. And this is, you know, in Buddhism, they talk about the grasping, clinging nature of the mind. And, yeah. and what you're talking about, it just shows how it's like the mind is like a cat you're holding over water or something. It's clinging on to anything just to stop itself from being in a state where it doesn't have a definition. It's terrified of that state. And it seems like this reminds me, there was a phone call that I listened to where somebody had freaked out. Actually, it was a guy who freaked out in India on acid in an ashram and was calling Ram Dass and telling him that he had to get committed to a mental asylum for a while. And Ram Dass's response was that, you know, what happened is you had your learning accelerated past, you had a really fast awakening, way too faster than maybe you were ready for.
Right.
And gaining all that information, you know, your ego wasn't able to assimilate it, so you resisted, and then you ended up in a mental hospital. And I don't know if this goes back to what you're saying. We want to make something good out of what's horrible. You know, I don't know if that's what it is, but it's just interesting to me how what you're describing prior to the fear kicking in seems to be some form of samadhi. It seems to be some kind of awakened state, including the dreams that you are having, where you are actually having dreams of other lifetimes. What was the name that you called those dreams?
Banalmares.
Banalmares, not nightmares, but banalmares, where you were dreaming all of these other lives. And again, when you hear stories of awakening, you hear that you begin to remember your past lives.
Right. If those are my past lives, I'm terrified of how boring my entire spin on this existence was. Because it was all modern jobs. It was like a tax attorney, the most clear one was the convenience store worker who got hit in the head when he was restocking the Diet Dr. Pepper. Like that stuck with me for a really long time. And what was terrifying is I felt like there was something I was supposed to be doing, but I couldn't remember it. And all I could do was sit in the utility room and just watch security footage for the duration of the dream.
Wow.
And it was just like, oh, God damn.
Well,
I guess that's what I'll do.
it's wild to think about the conceptualization of what we are as this kind of ocean of consciousness that for whatever reason is chosen to be transmitted through the particular antenna that is our bodies and ourself. And that when you've been sort of through chemicals or through meditation, we've been pushed out of that, it almost makes sense that that consciousness, your consciousness was just like, what you really are was suddenly just identifying with all these other meat antennas for a second, and you were just right. hopping around from one life to the next, and just experiencing those various incarnations, and then finally you landed back in yourself again.
Right. It's the way you're talking about it, it's almost as if the way water will expand to whatever container that's holding it. It's sort of like, I needed just a container. Like, give me a container, because if I don't have a container, I'm going everywhere.
Yes.
Like, and if I'm going everywhere, that's, I don't think my brain is ready for that. I'm probably some of your listeners and some of your gurus are ready for that. Like, I wasn't. Like, I struggled just to become myself again. I don't think I aspire to that state. Like, I think I was terrified by that state.
Well, because I mean, you know, obviously there's some serious differences here between that state of awakening or enlightenment and the state of having, like, as you describe it, what is it? Like, holding your synapses were spraying neurotransmitters as though someone were holding their thumb over the end of a hose. Is that something like that?
Yeah.
So, it's just, I hope I don't seem like I'm diminishing the terror and horror of what happens. It's just fascinating how it does parallel a lot of the ideas of waking up, which is this insane concept where you let go of your identity. You give it up. You let go. Yeah. You surrender. You stop being attached to the current form that you're taking. You're there. You're in it. It's not like you abandon it. You respect it, but you're no longer attached to it anymore. You've let go of yourself. It's that moment when you're walking down the path, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, you experience a spark of pure happiness, not based on any other thing. And then the moment you remember your life, you're like, ah, fuck. God damn it. I got to get to that fucking show tonight, and I'm late for the fucking thing, and I've got a meeting at 4, and how the fuck am I going to do my laundry? I'm exhausted. I didn't sleep the night before.
Right.
You know?
You know, it's interesting because there's something in that where the idea of sort of meditating or taking drugs or whatever to get to that state involves a certain level of dedication and control. And so there's still that sort of like desire for control within that. Like, I can control my enlightenment. I can be the one who's riding these horses versus like what I experienced was sort of like this terror that I'm what I consider myself are a bunch of molecules that if they fall out of place, I'm someone different. And they're tinier and I can't really picture them. But the fact that these electrical impulses keep happening and I keep end up being me is kind of a miracle. That I can have a through line of a personality even as all of these chemical processes are going through me.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Fuck yeah.
And so it's like that is terrifying to me because I have no control over that in the way I have no control over my islets of Langerhans in my pancreas. But like I don't sit here and worry about, oh, are my islets of Langerhans working in my pancreas? But I do about the synapses in my brain all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, that's the function of the brain, the function of the self or the mind, you know, is to, it just wants to be in to be the center of attention. It wants to be in charge. Right. It wants to be the number one main event of your life. And yeah. It's almost blasphemous to start letting go of that and realizing that this, you've basically been watching a cricket in a top hat do this endless dance in front of the Grand Canyon.
Right, right. And it reminds me of when we were talking about writing the last time, which is like, you know, the thing that always screws people up when they're writing is the fact what they want to write about. And it's just sort of like, right, you're privileging the cricket there. Yes. Like you have all of this stuff in your head, and God bless the head for holding all of that. And let's just really just have Ganesh come and dictate it out for us so that we can really get this down. And it's like, actually, that's getting in the way of you writing. Like yeah. that thing, that cricket who really wants to write this thing is the one who's getting in your way.
I'm a genius. Listen to me. I'm a yeah. genius. Don't you see it? I'm a genius. We're in trouble. Oh my God, we're in trouble.
Always think, like, go ahead.
Think about the applause I'll get if I write this. Think about like the back rubs I'll get and the milkshakes and the admiration of my peers and da 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 da. And it's all this stuff that like you're sitting alone at a chair. And you've populated the room with all of this other crap that has nothing to do with the blank page in front of you.
Exactly. And there you are walking along the path or sitting on your porch or doing whatever. And you experience this moment of such great happiness and bliss. And because it's completely unrelated to any activity or action that you did, that little fucking cricket has got to either distract you from it or take credit for it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Find some sort of causal thing. It's, oh, it must have been because I had that good breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank God I'm making healthy choices in my life again.
It's the liquid chlorophyll I've been drinking, clearly.
Right. Oh, I finally got her out of my life.
Yeah.
I finally, and then you can write down and be like, I finally experienced happiness today. I think it's because she's gone. And it's like, well, or you just experience happiness.
Yeah.
Like it's our need to make a sort of causal chain to any emotion that we have that is sort of, it's hilarious.
It is hilarious, that need. And it's the big, it's like one of the big problems is because you can't imagine, you just can't accept the idea that if you give up the errands,
right.
Give up the errands. It doesn't mean stop running the errands, but you give up the errands mid-errand. You're still running the errand, whatever, but you just give it up. And you land in this moment. You land in this moment, and it's generally amazing. You're in a right. train station. You've forgotten everything, and you're fine. Until.
Yeah. Until. Yeah.
Until you realize you've lost your identity, and you can't get it back. It's just right. gone. That's the big difference between these samsaric or satori states that can happen to a person from time to time. If you've eaten some good marijuana or you've been jogging or you've enjoyed a nice meal or you've had great sex or whatever, the difference right, right. is we get to come back to ourselves if we want to. What happened to you is that option was gone.
Yeah. Yeah, it was gone, and then Josh Rajesh, the tourist police officer, takes me to a house where the woman, her son, had died overdosing on drugs, and they had a mini intervention for me. And what do you do in a mini intervention when, like, somebody's mother is crying over their dead son, but, like, cry back at him and apologize?
It's incredible. Can I read that part from the book?
Sure.
Hold on. Just one second. Let me pause this. I just realized I should have the author read from his text. I don't know why I was going to do it. What an asshole I am.
I kind of liked it better. I hear it. Me read it all the time. So she, Mrs. Lee and Rajesh have a mini intervention for me. And I'm just going to read from the middle of it.
This is directly after David has been found in a train station with complete amnesia.
Mrs. Lee then began to cry. I cried right back at her. It was people like me who had killed her son. People like me. I put my hand on hers and told her I was sorry, that I'd do better, that I was done with all of the drugs, forever. My insides felt like they'd just fallen into an abandoned well. The gray static and fuzz from before was replaced with a black hopelessness. Mrs. Lee took a napkin, folded it three times, wiped at her black eyes, and excused herself. Rajesh pulled his cap off his knee and leaned forward, his forearms settling on his thighs. Now you see why I brought you here. She is a woman who can teach you things. He took a sip from his tea. He smacked his legs with open palms, signaling the end of the lesson. Then Mrs. Lee takes me upstairs to where I'm going to sleep for the night. An off-balance ceiling fan spastically stirred the air. I walked directly to the window. There was a narrow balcony outside, and I yanked at the glass door to reach it. Here, it needs to be unlocked first. Mrs. Lee bent down and flicked a piece of metal, and the door opened with a screech. On the street, a man pushed a cart loaded with stacks of paper. He rang a bell as he walked and called out to each of the houses. Four puppies rolled and snapped at one another in the gutter. A woman ironed clothes in a small storefront across the street. There was a braid of wrist-thick black electrical cables coming out of a pipe not 5 feet from the balcony. They swayed heavily in the breeze and stretched across the street, stitching the buildings together. Cinch them tight, and you'd close the open wound of the street. There was a flutter of movement above me. Three small children chased each other around the open roof of the opposite building. On the building next door to that one, a pair of children stared straight into the sky while fiddling with their hands. I craned my neck to see what they saw. A kite. The string was nearly invisible in their hands and in the sky, but the small patch of color was clearly leashed to them. Something whirred in my brain. I stared again at the building opposite. On the roof was a small flat. "That's my apartment," I told Mrs. Lee. Excitement crackled in my throat. I pictured pushing open the door and finding the squalid flat where Christina and I used to hole ourselves up in while we shot up with heroin and whatever else we could find. The flat was dark. Even during the day, it was dark. Miserable, with a laughably thin mattress where Christina and I would crash and moan between highs. Standing on Mrs. Lee's balcony, I yearned to go over there, yank the padlock off the door, and enter into my horrible and wasted life. I could see now, though, how bad this was. I could go over and collect the redhead and get us both some help. Mrs. Lee and Josh would help us. We'd be okay. "You don't live there," Mrs. Lee corrected. "I do. I just rented the place." "No one lives there. It's abandoned." "Right. It was. Then I moved in." I was sweating with conviction. Why was Mrs. Lee trying to keep me from my apartment? Suddenly, I was awash in paranoia. Mrs. Lee and Josh were the ones who drugged me. They were trying to keep me away from Christina. They were trying to rob me. I wasn't confused. They were making me confused. "That's my apartment," I said again, pleading with Mrs. Lee to let me go. Mrs. Lee grasped my shoulders and said, "That is not your flat. Do you think you could move into my neighborhood and me not know about it?" She was right, but if that wasn't my apartment, how in the world was I remembering it so vividly? Now I couldn't be sure of the memories that I did have. Everything was suspect. I was worse than a drug addict. I was nothing. A drug addict could cry over his wasted life. I didn't know what life my tears were for. There was only an absence. I cried for something I didn't know. The braid of black wire swaying in the breeze now asserted itself as a fair ending. I could jump out and grab them. End this. Sizzle away this not knowing. Let the people in the street scrape me off their sandals. Send the inky fried residue to my mother in a box. Give it to her to cry over when guests come. Let me jump. Let me end this. Please. So, you know, it's a happy book. It's good to give to your parents.
It's good to give to people who just got amnesia.
It really is. Everybody's just
actually,
so happy.
I think it is, man. I think that, you know, that it is I mean, God, the what you just described is and so many times in the beginning reading the book, I experienced varying states of claustrophobia and anxiety related to that, that feeling. The closest approximation I can get to it, Dave, is once when I was in, an idiot in high school. I decided to try an inhalant. I decided to, because some idiot kids were breathing butane gas out of bags. You know, I had some pretty awful friends. So I was I know. Butane gas. That's what we were doing. And so I can remember sitting in my bedroom with this bag of a plastic bag and some butane gas, and I spray the butane gas into the bag and you breathe it in. And I don't know if you've ever done nitrous oxide, but you start getting that weird echoey effect, like boom, 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 wong, 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 wong. Every rustle of the bag, kind of like you're in an echo chamber, just whoop. And then all of a sudden, I was no longer myself. I was plunging down a number line, just plunging down a number line. I had no idea who I was or what I was. I was rolling down a number line, and wow, then I landed on absolute zero and realized that I would be here infinitely a nothing, just a no thing, no identity forever. And it was the most horrifying moment. Yeah. And when I came out of it, it was, you know, I was just stricken. And ever since then, I've been a little stricken with, like, Jesus, God, is that what waits for us after we die? Just this sense of awareness with nothing to identify with, you know? But that feeling of loss minus the memory of what you've lost.
Right. It's the idea that I was happier killing my mother and making my mother sad than I was not knowing who I was, right? Because at least I could play that role, right? At least I could play the role of the repentant drug addict. But if I wasn't that, then who was I? And that was worse.
Yeah, man. And that's where things get really heavy. That's where things start getting really heavy when you consider that our minds are so advanced and so creative that they can instantaneously manufacture a biography.
Yeah.
Instantaneously fill in blanks with people who don't exist, with things that never happened, with locations that we never lived in. When you realize the potency of the human mind to create, it really does bring you back into these mystical traditions that say, you know, as you know, even in the book of Genesis, when God says, I made man in my image, a creating being, a being that is just like me. I am the thing that created the entire universe. And so these expressions or expansions of me, which are human beings, they are also these creative forces. They're also able to create entire universes subjectively that they can live inside of. When you witness the potency of the mind in that way, it's beautiful and unnerving.
Yeah. Wow. That was beautiful.
Ah, thank you.
That's really great. No, it's like the weird plasticity of the brain to sort of like to protect itself, to sort of, I don't know, there's something so interesting about how much bigger it is. And also how lame it is. Like, like the fact that the story that I came up with was just some sort of like feel bad about myself, repentant, blah, blah. I mean, it's sort of like, oh, so I just moved into a cliche.
Yes.
Right? Like,
and how many of us are living in a cliche anyway? You know, like how many of us are already in the cliche, you know, because my life, like, let's say that you somehow every memory, everything that I experienced truly was recorded in my brain. And there were five different souls that got to live inside my body and pick which memories they wanted to assemble to make their own identity. You know, you would have five completely different lives.
Yeah,
five completely different lives. Some lives would be more tragic. Some lives would be the greatest thing ever. Some, who knows, depending on the assembler, the thing that was assembling all these memories, whoever that assembler was, that would define who you were.
And at what point they jumped in and started assembling, right?
Yeah.
It's that teleological thing where you decide at this point, I've reached this place and now I can look back and see all the causal things that led me to this place. And you, that's fine, except you have to realize that that place that you're assembling from is arbitrary. Mm. And that you're making this narrative, and it's a totally arbitrary narrative. Because the causal link is will be different tomorrow, and will be different the day after that.
Yeah.
And this is when we were talking about writing again, it's like, I sometimes say that the worst thing that can happen to a writer is like a diagnosis, because what they then do is ignore everything in their lives that doesn't fit the diagnosis, and that the diagnosis fits now is the ordering brain in the self. And so everything that doesn't fit the diagnosis will eschew. And we won't pay attention to, because that our experience needs to fit what the scientist told us that it would be.
Oh God, man, that's incredible. And especially when the diagnosis comes from our parents or comes from our society or comes from our friends or comes from whoever. And the diagnosis is you're a crazy guy.
Right. And you just sort of like, you look back and you're like, well, there, and there, you might have a point. If somebody's like, you've always been loving, and it's like, well, there, and there, you have a point. You're right.
Yeah.
But it's kind of totally arbitrary.
It is so fucking arbitrary. You take a kid and you put, it's like, especially when you cling to the thing, when you cling to the ego. Like, imagine if when you were an 8-year-old, you put on a costume for a Halloween party and somebody forced you to wear that until you were 12, you know, and pretend that you were that character until you were 12. And the thing's going to start cracking and peeling off, and the clothes are going to get mildewed and disgusting, and you're going to get split at the seams. You eventually won't be able to wear it anymore at all. You know, that's what happens to people, is we decide like, oh, here's what I am. Talk about a fucking diagnosis. Here's a terrifying diagnosis. I'm a writer. I'm a comedian. Yeah. I'm a plumber. I'm a whatever. There's your diagnosis.
Right. As if none of those, anything that doesn't behave inside of that behavior of that diagnosis then gets ignored or pared away. Where we'll nicely sort of sculpt our lives to match whatever this nonsense that we think we are is, as opposed to like the other things in our lives that are what's really interesting. It's the stuff that doesn't fit that's more interesting.
Yeah, and it's that you know, when I the you know, when I see like really great comics,
right.
Carlin, I'll think, oh, he's not a stand-up comic, he's a genius who's using stand-up comedy as a tool to articulate his thoughts or to articulate a bigger thing. But he's not a comic, he's just using it in the way that you pick up a pen to write. He's using this medium to is a tool, because he's gotten out of the thing itself, bigger than the thing. He's using it as a tool, you know.
It's interesting because early in his career he was a comic. You see when he was doing the hippy dippy weatherman, he was a comic.
Exactly.
And then like there's something in the 1980s when he was doing those HBO specials, something flipped and he was no longer a comic. He was this other thing that was acting like a comic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so that's where you get back into this mystical idea, which is we're all this other thing acting like a person, you know, and using this form to sort of be a thing for a little while. And what you, I like to believe that what like this a lot of the saints say, like Rumi and Neem Karoli Baba and Ram Dass, who say that the thing using this vehicle, this body to play out, to play this game, this Leela as they call it, is love. Transcendent love. It's just pure love that's using this vehicle to play this really intense, very dramatic game of make-believe. I like to believe that. But there's another side of me that's like, or is it actually a screaming zero on a number line manufacturing all of these lives just to do anything to escape from the catastrophe that happened to the universe the moment it woke up? Only it wasn't in a fucking train station. It was everything. Think about that. You're a universe and you suddenly wake up in the midst of infinity and you are infinity. There's nobody there. There's no one to take you to a place and take care of you. You're just one unified thing that just woke up and you're freaking the fuck out. What are you going to do? You're going to start creating a bunch of hallucinatory identities to desperately try to avoid or relieve this terrible horror of being a mote of everythingness, completely alone and self-aware.
Right. And so you make up this thing that has to go get the Honey Nut Cheerios.
Yes.
Right? You got to make up Honey Nut Cheerios. You got to surround yourself with these things, and these things mean something. Because if they don't mean something, then everything means nothing. And if everything is everything, then we're really fucked.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Because then what do we do with ourselves?
Yeah. 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 What do we do with ourselves? You know, and you know, I'm going to defer to people who have been practicing meditation for their entire lives and believe out of faith what they say. But because I don't think they would bullshit. You know, I think that somewhere even behind that, I think behind even the universe screaming in the infinite void, that's the big first identity. And even behind that, there's still this thing, this, you know, the nameless thing that we can't understand, but which flows through everything outside of time. So I hope that's true. But it's interesting to think that for that your amnesia, that getting amnesia put you in the exact situation post Big Bang, whenever the first thing woke up.
Yeah. It's funny, and so I've been talking with this neuroscientist in New York, and what happened to me is actually more rare than I had originally thought. And so there are two kinds of amnesia. There's like retrograde amnesia. There's RA and AA, and it's rare to have. And some people thought it was impossible to have what I have had without a corresponding severe AA. And what this guy did is he wrote a paper about it in the 90s about this one guy. And as soon as he heard my story, he was like, please come, because everybody's been calling me like controversial because I believe that this can happen. And so like I'm going to New York to sit in an MRI chamber and do all of that again and do PET scans and stuff. But it's really neat. It's really sort of interesting because – because we have these experiences that don't line up with diagnoses, sometimes we think that we don't have them, or we think that those experiences are just an aspect of, or a regrettable aspect of our personality, when actually it's just the world hasn't gotten around to defining it yet.
Oh, yeah.
And that's part of your job, is to like lend that thing that's you, that's outside of all definition, to the definition of the world, right? That it's like, this is, if we can all just sort of take a second, think of that we're all just guinea pigs in the really long scope, and embrace that role, and be good guinea pigs and be like, this is my experience in life. This is what I think is really different from the way it seems everybody else experiences life. That would be the, as opposed to trying so desperately to force the weirdness of ourselves into safe blocks that the church or science or academia has told us to be in.
Yeah, it's like those Play-Doh things, you know, where you put the Play-Doh in and you squeeze it out and it turns it into little stars or circles or the hair coming out of the Play-Doh person. That's the that's the thing that you'll end up doing if you're, you know, that's the a natural thing to end up doing is you try to squeeze your experience of being an infinite being through these predetermined shapes that we call words. And squeeze them out, and that's who you are. But it's like, come on, that's that. What you were existed way before the words. Human beings existed way before the words to articulate our experience happened. So to think,
Well, I mean, the problem also is that there is a moment of feeling safe when you go into one of the pre-made forms. Like you can feel comfortable and there's a sort of like, there's a niceness to it. Like now you don't have to worry. Now you're a fireman. You're fine. You're a fireman. You're no longer, right? And it's like, you're a fireman with a meth problem, but you're a fireman. like it's like you, there's something so nice about that, about finally finding a form that you, you then neglect all the other forms that you still are. You just try your best to will them away.
Oh God, man. It's like we're infinity and our identity is a hot tub and we're just in some kind of vacation state where you just take a little dip into yourself for a while just to experience that. Ah, finally something to confine me.
Oh, man.
This is great. Thank God.
Orwell talks about like the way you wear a mask long enough, your face conforms to the mask, and you become the mask.
Yeah.
And he was like, when he was like a colonial soldier in India or in Burma, but no, you act like something long enough, and you just end up becoming that thing, and sort of calcifying into that thing,
and you become fucking certain of not the moment you calcify into the thing, you calcify into a certain set of outcomes.
Yeah,
you just know how things are going to end up, don't you?
Yeah.
You know who? Yeah.
Oh yeah, but that's almost like all like American homespun wisdom, like from the porch, like sort of always knew that. People always knew it was going to happen like that. And there's an assurance in that sort of wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so safe and it's so weak. Have you seen that Small Town Security? It's on Netflix. Have you seen this yet? Wow, man. You got to watch this. It's the greatest reality show I've ever seen. It's about this small security firm in Georgia. And I don't know who shot it. It's like David Lynch decided to do a reality show or something because it's just brilliant. Like it's this one of the main security guard is a woman who's been going through hormone replacement therapy to turn into a man. The lady running it used to be this actress in B movies, and she's just this kind of diva. It's like they're all just such fascinating individuals. One of the guys, the lady's husband, is a hoarder. And, you know, he keeps saying that he's going to clean out his office and it's just like stacked with hoarder shit. And everyone just keeps saying, he won't do it. He won't do it. He's not going to do it. And they say it with this certainty. They're just like, we know him so well. We know that he will not do it. And there's so much comfort in feeling like you know yourself that well. You know, that's something I would never ever do. That's not how I am. That's not what I'm like. And that is so very comfortable. But God, What a tragic way to be, huh? Ultimately, that's a tragic way to just know what you're like.
It's funny because as soon as that person actually does it, it's amazing to watch the psychic disruption that happens among all of that community, because his reluctance to get rid of the stuff made people feel safe in their lives.
Yeah.
They're like, I woke up today. I can count on him not getting rid of his stuff.
You know what's amazing is because the reason he said he was going to get rid of his stuff is because he wanted to shape up the security firm. And he's like, I guess I've just got to, you know, lead by example. And you're damn right, because then the moment he cleans up everything, then all the other people are going to see, like, oh, shit, you can change.
Yeah.
You can change. And that's where you got two types of friends, don't you? You got the friends who are totally cool with you changing, and you got the friends who are terrified of you changing.
Right.
Well, I guess that means there's only one kind of friend, and then there's demons.
Well, it's funny. Do you remember The Iceman Cometh, the Eugene O'Neill play?
Yeah, I know of it, but I'm not familiar with it.
Like, the whole play is like, this guy is going to come back. He comes every year, and he buys everybody drinks. And when he buys everybody drinks, it's really great, and it's really fun. And he tells the story about finding his wife fucking the Iceman, who had come by and was fucking the Iceman. And everybody loves it when he comes by. And this year he comes by, and instead he tries to get everybody sober and, like, to finish their dreams and do what they wanted, what they believe they is holding them back. And you could see how horrible it is for all of these people. Like, for him to come in and the sort of, like, meanness of spirit it takes to be – to sort of help other people live their pipe dreams.
Yeah.
And so he comes in. It's like this aggressive, violent force. And then you realize the play is amazing. They just did it in Chicago with, like, Brian Dennehy and Nathan Lane. And it's like 5 hours long. And then, like, it turns out, like, shit had gone crazy bat fuck in his life. And so he wanted to save other people instead of his dealing with his life. Ugh. And everybody was so happy when he finally fell, because it meant that they didn't have to change their lives.
Oh, wow.
It's just like, yes, whatever that is. And to do that arc in 5 hours it's an amazing play.
Wow, man. Yeah, that is, you know, that you know, you're not just going to get resistance from the identity that you think you are. You're going to get resistance from all the people who want that identity to stay the same fucking way.
Right.
I'm sure it's the same thing. Who plays Harry Potter?
Yeah, Daniel Radcliffe.
I'm sure Daniel Radcliffe, again and again and again, has to deal with the abject disappointment of certain people around him when they recognize that this is not Harry fucking Potter.
Right.
And they want him to be Harry Potter so bad. It's the way I'd feel around Emilia Clarke. You know her? She plays Khaleesi in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, right?
You know what I mean? You'd want her to be Khaleesi. Be the queen, the mother of dragons. Can you be the, you want to kind of, like, hint at it? You know, like, I know, can we watch, when we watch the news tonight, can we watch it, but you're Khaleesi just for 10 minutes?
Just a little bit, please. It's funny, like, to be around actors, especially actors that you've seen in stuff that you've watched in your underwear.
Yeah.
Because you feel like you have a bond with this person because they were there when you were alone.
Wow.
And,
yeah.
And so you find yourself, like, sort of almost when you're, like, at a Mexican restaurant with the famous person, you're almost like that self of aloneness is sort of communing with the image of that person.
Mm.
Without them really wanting it. And I can imagine it being horrible to have to deal with that all the time.
Yeah.
That, like, everybody's underwear self is always sort of interacting with you.
Yeah, and everybody's wanting, you know, no one really knows you. What a lonely feeling. Everybody's in love with a phantom that you created. I mean, that's pretty intense. And I think that's one of the like one of the interesting moments when you recognize that this role, this identity, this ego that you think is yourself is in fact just a fabrication, an assemblage of memories that you've decided to put together to identify you as you. And that's where you get into a place. This is where, like, Jack Kornfield and Ram Dass, they say, respect the roles. Just because you've identified that this thing right. is just a thing you've manufactured, that doesn't mean that now you're going to suddenly act like something different. No. Just now yeah. you know you're playing a part. That's the difference. Now you recognize that you're bigger than what you currently have been pretending to be. That's just an interesting moment. That's you're not attached as much anymore. I want to find, if you don't mind, I have something I was hoping you, so another passage I was hoping you would read. Hold on 1 second. 1 second. So sorry. Can I ask you to read one more thing, David?
Sure.
Just real quick. Yeah. Sorry. Dave McLean's been on all these reading tours, and I guess it probably gets old to have to read this stuff again and again. I just asked him what page something was on his book, and the pages in a 289, you know where everything is on every page, but I was hoping you could read just on page 282, if you could just read that last paragraph, because I just thought it was so beautiful.
All right, give me a second here. Oh, yeah.
In the chaos of this world where we caroom and collide in the everyday turbulence, there's something about the specific gravity of the helpless individual, the lost and the fractured, that draws kindness from us like venom from a wound.
Ah, God. I love that so much, man. I've never heard such a perfect description of what happens when you start serving other people or helping other people. How it feels as though a venom is being taken out, a poison is being drawn from you by the act of service to other people, and there's just nothing like it, man.
Yeah,
there's nothing like it, and. You know, when I was reading that, I was thinking, like, if you begin to apply that idea to the notion that you, the identity that you think you are, is a lost thing, or even take that back further, which is that this entire universe is this lost thing. And then you realize that not only is the imperative then to serve the people around you, but to recognize and have compassion for yourself as this lost thing in yeah. a train station called the universe. You know, that kind of compassion, which is like, hey, I don't know who I am either, man.
Yeah.
But I'm going to love and serve you as much as I possibly can. This me, this role, this identity, this thing that I've temporarily inhabiting here, as much as I can. I'm going to have the same compassion that I would have for myself, that I would have for someone who ends up with amnesia in a train station in India. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. It's. I think about it like when you see somebody fall, and you're not the one, you see somebody else help that person, right? You see somebody fall and your first reaction wasn't to help that person. You see somebody get there first and then like you sort of pantomime going over to help the person. You're yeah. like, oh, me too. I care too.
Yeah.
But it's like the way our brain, or if you don't help at all, like watch those first thoughts after not helping. Like what are the ones that go in? Is it the ones that are like, well, I've got to be somewhere. Well, that person deserved it because they shouldn't have been walking so fast, or da 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 da. Watch those thoughts, because those thoughts are really your flinches away from interacting with the world. Like those are the ones that like those are the ones that are like pulling you somewhere, and are your lie. And I do this all the time, so I'm not saying I'm not saying I help everyone who needs help by any stretch of the imagination, but I watch my brain and see what are those thoughts? What am I using to justify not helping someone?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Say, you know what? The thoughts you're using to not help someone are the same thoughts you're using to not help yourself. It's the same thoughts you're using to keep yourself exactly in the place that you're at. It's the same aspect of procrastination, or, you know, when you look at yourself and you think, I'm more out of shape than I'd like to be, you know, and then instead of going to exercise, you're like, no, you this is what you're like. You deserve it. This is just the way you've been. So what's the point? Why help you? Why would I even help you? This thing that's been eating too many Doritos and hasn't been, you know, it's the same exact thing, man. And
this is what you deserve. You keep eating that block of cheese like that, of course you're going to be fat.
Yes.
Right. So I say that to myself all the time.
Why stop now? Why stop now? Right. That's what every zombie thinks, is it's chewing somebody's brain up. Why stop now? I've been eating brains for months.
I guess that's who I am. I'm just a brain eater.
Man, David, yeah, wow. I was blown away by this book. And if I didn't know you, I would still be blown away with this book. I put this in the same level as Crack Hour, you know, you know that book? Into the Void, you know that book?
Into thin air,
right? It has this combination. It's so beautiful because it's this combination of describing larium, a beautifully articulated dose of neurology that's very accessible and easy to understand, but it's mixed in with this. It's an adventure story, man. It really is. It's one of these kind of catastrophic adventure stories where a person finds themselves in a life or death situation, and how they got out of that situation. And just like all great adventure stories, to get out of the situation, it seems like you got to lose a part of yourself. You know, it's like no matter what, you either have to lose friends, you have to lose an arm. In the case of that guy who got the boulder stuck on his arm and had to saw his fucking arm off. For you, you had to lose the feeling that you will always be David McLean. You had to lose the naive innocence that we all get to enjoy who haven't experienced the obliteration of our past, that this thing that we think we are will always continue into the future. That's a huge sacrifice. That's an incredible thing to lose. So what a beautiful, beautiful book.
That was a great way to say that. I'm going to remember that. That was really great. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And tell everybody where they can find you, and I'll have links to the book on my website so that people can order it. But where can they find you?
Next couple of weeks, I'm going to be in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Woo woo! And Santa Fe, New Mexico. So that's like March 13th and 14th. And then in Boulder and Denver, Boulder on the 19th and Denver on the 21st. And it's all on my web page. And then a bunch of places in April.
And what's your website?
DavidStuartMcLean.com.
And on Twitter, what are you?
David S. McLean.
Great. I'll have all those links at DuncanTrussell.com. Go to the comment section of the website so that you can connect with David and buy this book. If you're going to read any book this year, this is the book to read. And I'm not just saying that because this is one of my best friends who thanks me at the end of the book. Yes.
And you're a character.
I'm in the book. What an honor, man. Because it's it's such a good book. David, thank you so much for being on the show again.
Thank you.
And great. I love you.
I love you too, man. Good talking to you.
Good talking to you.